the newest release, 40 Years of Lonesome. Once again, that's Kathy Boyd and Phoenix Rising, Friday, April 20th, Reedwood Friends Church, 2901 Southeast Steel Street, Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is also available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Board meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month, starting at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
This is KBOO Portland.
Good morning. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm your host, as usual, Paul Roland. We have got a show for you today. We are going to wade into the Syrian situation, what I call the quagmire of atrocity. And we've got on the line from, I believe he's in Scotland. We'll check that just real soon here, Idris Ahmad, who is a co-editor of Pulse, a political web blog, with two other people, and he has written, he writes for just a wide proliferation of sources, including The Nation and many others, and he has well, this is an incredibly complex situation, and he's got his take on it. And there are many other takes, and hopefully you who are listening will call in with your questions and maybe your take on the situation. Now, a little bit of context. Robert Fisk, who's a renowned veteran journalist, kind of a giant in some ways of Middle East journalism, has written a widely circulated article basically calling into question the whether that the gas attack, the gas bomb that is alleged to have exploded and killed many people in Douma about a little over a week ago, it did not actually occur. And that's seems to be a part of a pattern, according to Idris Ahmad, of reporting what he considers actually in a somewhat very condemnatory piece that he wrote in December 2016. I'm talking about Idris Ahmad, called Robert Fisk Crimes Against Journalism. Okay, so that's enough of preface. We've got a lot to talk about. Are you on the line with us?
I am.
Good. You sound clear. Are you indeed in Scotland?
I am, yes.
Okay. It's always nice to know physically where we're talking to people in. And so, of course, the UK along with France and the United States, are the ones who carried out this missile attack in response to this this incident, whether it was or was not a gas attack. You may have your own take on that. But yeah, this is an incredibly a tangled, complex story. It goes historically very complex, like all other Middle East. There's a lot of Western involvement historically in Syria, including CIA, the way that the Assad family came to power. The political situation is incredibly messy. The stakes are incredibly high. It's incredibly charged. You've got Iran involved. You know, you've got ISIS. There's just so many facets to this. So we appreciate your taking the time to help us sort it out. But specifically, I called on you because, you know, this article by Robert Fisk that's making the rounds what's the title of it? To find out what's really going on in what really happened in Douma. So lay it out for us. So first of all, why did you write this article, Robert Fisk's Crimes Against Journalism?
Well, I think it'll be best for me to begin with the current case. Now, if anyone other than Robert Fisk had written this article, in which he goes and speaks to a person who did not witness the incident and who speaks to no person who was directly involved in the incident, and from that he makes this big conclusion, draws conclusion for which he has absolutely no grounds. And if anybody else had written it, we would be dismissing it. We won't be talking about it. But it's Robert Fisk. So here we are discussing what Robert Fisk is talking about. And now the thing is, I teach journalism at a university. So for me, whenever a piece comes out, my main consideration is, okay, if a claim is being made, what is the evidence on which is being made? And is the evidence corroborated? And if you look at the Fisk piece, it fails every one of those tests. Its main, the main person it relies on has not witnessed the incident and is not directly involved and has a theory. And he meets no other person who was directly involved. And then he makes a very absurd claim that he says that he's wondering that why all these people who were directly affected have left. And so he's trying to even turn that into some kind of a suggestion that why are people in Turkey talking openly about it while people in Douma who are in that place where the dictatorship for years, I mean, so Douma is not too far from the Seyed Nayef prison where Amnesty had done an extensive report about 13,000 people just in one prison, 13,000 people, civilians, being executed, sometimes 50 over every night. So we are talking about a place, it is next to the Gulag, the worst Gulag in Syria, and this incident is occurring. He's going into a place, a fallen city, and he hears this hearsay account and makes this big claim, and he uses his name, Robert Fisk, the legendary British journalist, to push this absolutely absurd and absolutely conspiratorial theory. So that is my main problem with it, but this is part of a consistent pattern. So this is not something new that Robert Fisk is doing. I mean, he had done something not too far from Douma, is a place called Daraya. So in 2012, there had been a massacre in Daraya, and nearly, the estimates range from up to 500 people were killed in that massacre. Now, quickly, because Syria is, even the besieged areas are not exactly shut off from the world, be it people have Skype, people have telephones, so it is possible to contact. Even when Douma was under siege, I was able to contact many journalists, many medics, many people who were there through WhatsApp and through other kinds of other forms of communication. So it was rather quickly obvious what had happened in Daraya. The regime committed a massive massacre. But next day what happened is that Robert Fisk gets taken in. He rides a tank into the town where the regime has just committed a massacre, and he speaks to four people. None of them tell him what he puts in the headline. He claims, well, there was the massacre was committed by the opposition, and he says that the massacre was part of a failed prison swap deal, and that's when the opposition committed the massacre. Now, the thing is that even the four witnesses that he quotes in his article, none of them actually say what he says. So the only person who says that the dead might have been government officials also says that he did not see them, but he believes that they might have been government supporters. So once again, hearsay completely unsupported by evidence, and that's when it started. This is middle of 2012 that we are talking about, and this whole campaign of disinformation starts. And Fisk has since then written many stories like that, and that's one of the reasons that compelled me. In fact, there was a trigger for it, which I'll mention later on, that which compelled me to write that story, because one of the things he did was he tried to smear a Scottish charity which had donated ambulances to medics in Syria, and he tried to smear them in an article, once again based on absolutely no evidence. And that's when I felt compelled to write an article looking at his methods.
Well, let's jump forward again to this article again, and mm-hmm. people should feel free to call in at 503-231-8187, because you might well have a more of a grasp on the situation than I do, and have a good questions to direct towards my guest, Idriss Ahmad, who we have on the line from Scotland. And so we're talking about this piece by Robert Fisk, which appeared in The Independent just a few days ago, called The Search for the Truth in Douma. And I think the person you're referring to, who you said didn't witness this attack, he is a 58-year-old senior Syrian doctor. He says the patients, he says, he talks about what he says really happened with this situation, uh-huh. with the alleged gas attack. He says the patients in this underground clinic were overcome not by gas, but by oxygen starvation in the rubbish-filled tunnels and basements in which they lived on a night of wind and heavy shelling that stirred up a dust storm. As Dr. Asim Rahalbani announces this extraordinary conclusion, it is worth observing that he is, by his own admission, not an eyewitness himself, and as he speaks good English, he refers twice to the jihadi gunman. Anyway, gets on into stuff that requires a lot of understanding of the context. So he says that it wasn't a gas attack. It was actually oxygen starvation in the rubbish-filled tunnels and basements. Okay, so what is your best understanding of what actually occurred?
Well, I think it's rather clear what occurred that day, because it's been not just until now all the evidence that is there, the body of evidence that is verifiable and which is not even in dispute, because a CBS crew at the same time as Fisk went there, a CBS crew also went there, and it actually, if you see the footage, it's just it was broadcast yesterday morning, and you can find it online, and you actually see the chlorine container. It's actually a mixture of chlorine with other toxic chemicals that was used. So that dropped on the roof of this one building, and the building is known, and it was immediately photographed even the day it happened. And then when the CBS crew arrived there, they saw with the container still lying there. So there's no kind of doubt about what happened, something which was aerially dropped, and obviously for which there's no capacity among anybody else other than either Russia or the regime, and Russia is unlikely to have used chemical weapon. So it's rather obvious that what has happened, and the evidence is also verifiable because the World Health Organization has treated many people, and also people have been the ones who have left from there, so they have had blood tests and everything done. So it's clear that there has a chemical attack has happened over there. And also Fisk, he just makes up stuff, because he, one of the claims he makes is that all these people were the affected, that they were all in basements, and that's why it was actually oxygen that affected them. But actually, no, most of the people who were directly affected were not in the basements, and several of them were actually affected when they were in their living quarters. So now there were this whole story again, he tries to tie it up with the tunnels underground. So there's a kind of a deep journalistic irresponsibility here, beginning with the fact that he goes to a place which has just fallen, which is under regime control, and he speaks to people, and everybody tells him the kind of thing that endorses the regime's narrative. I mean, shouldn't that be the first thing that brings everything into doubt? That if you're going to a place where people are living under terror and they say things which people living under terror are expected to say. So there's a responsible journalist would be a bit doubtful. They would try to find out, well, okay, maybe if they are saying this, is there a possibility of somebody having a different point of view?
So you realize, obviously, that you're taking on, as I said, a kind of a giant of a Middle Eastern reporting. He's been a correspondent for The Independent, primarily based in Beirut since 1988. He's been Middle East correspondent intermittently since 1976 for various media. He's won numerous awards. He's written numerous books. So, the situation there is incredibly serious. That obviously those of us who are not there have no way of really being able to grasp what's actually going on the ground. But you obviously have talked to people on the ground, so you have more than we do. So there's the situation on the ground. There's the overall international political situation. You know, there's obviously the history of Western involvement there. There's the various various interests that different countries have in that region and their own reasons for doing what they're doing. And then you've got Fisk and his reporting and other people's reporting. There's a lot going on. So why do you think Fisk would be do you respect his other reporting that he's done?
Well, the thing is that Fisk in the 80s and 90s, he used to have a reputation, and a lot of people used to admire him. So did I, until I would say about 2005. I also thought that he was a good journalist. I actually, in 2005, he was here in Scotland, and I had a chat with him back then. And back then, I used to think that he's a reliable journalist, but then a lot of things came out since then which have cast doubt on his, not only on his independence, but I would go so far as to say that his integrity, because one of the things that that is quite troubling is that I mentioned that one incident that where in Daraya he went there and he made this completely false claim, and which was immediately debunked because there's a veteran American correspondent, Janine DiGiovanni. So next day she sneaked in without government minders, and she openly spoke to all the people who were there, and all of them confirmed to her that obviously the government had carried out a massacre. So what has happened is that in case of Fisk, this is not the first time he's going there. And one of the other things you have to consider, I mean, because this is one of the things that Fisk used to criticize about mainstream reporting, which was that how embedding compromise is good journalism. Now, Fisk, this is the seventh year of the conflict, and Fisk has, throughout this period, has reported exclusively embedded with the regime. So he has reported exclusively from the regime's side, and the regime doesn't allow any journalist to go anywhere without minders. I mean, even if you watch the CBS documentary, sorry, the report from yesterday, the journalist is walking around, and you have all the armed men following him around everywhere. So this is another thing which should give you a bit of skepticism about Fisk, is that from Syria, anybody who has reported critically, they have never then been allowed to return to Syria. They have never then been granted the visas again, including the journalist I mentioned, Janine DiGiovanni, that you write one critical word about the regime, and then your visa gets revoked. And yet here's a person who for 7 years, he keeps on returning there. He keeps reporting embedded, and he does things which are simply unethical. One of the courses that I teach at the university is on journalism ethics. And one of the things which you never do is that you don't interview people under duress. So here's another story which I should mention, that he went to one of the regime's most notorious prisons, and he interviewed 4 detainees there. And the detainees told him everything that you would expect a detainee under the regime custody to say. They said that, how, yes, indeed, we are terrorists, and indeed, we have been supported by the West, and all those kinds of things. And he comes out, and then he publishes it as a big scoop. You know, now, any responsible journalist would have first said, well, okay, is it possible that these people were speaking under duress because they are in regime's custody? And if they told the truth, they face extreme consequences because most of the people from that prison never made it out alive. So what kind of ethics would go into going to a prison under a regime which is known for its brutality, whose torture apparatus is, they literally, I mean, this is actually part of history. That one of the people that they used for training their the torturers and the interrogators was a former Nazi. And so the thing is that you have an actual regime which engages, which is a well-known practitioner of torture, and here's a guy who goes to one of its prisons and then reports the findings that he speaks to some prisoners and then reports them as fact without any skepticism.
Well, you know, I do want to say that this kind of came up fairly recently, reaching out to you, in fact, just yesterday, and I didn't reach out to try to get a hold of Robert Fisk. I guess I thought it would be a lot more difficult. You just happened to have a way to contact Pulse directly, so that's why you responded. So I just want to say that this is we're not getting Robert Fisk's side. If anybody wants to take that side, please feel free to call in at 503-231-8187. And you know, we don't want to make this about one Western journalist, since obviously what's going on there is way beyond, you know, the issues about the integrity of one journalist. The only reason we're focusing on him is because of his reputation and him inserting himself into this with his that issue, which calls into question the gas attack, which of course was such a major focus of international attention. So I don't know, would you speculate as to why you think, assuming again all your the accusations you're laying out against Fisk's journalism are accurate, that, you know, what's he playing here? Is he like trying to extend the life of his career or something?
I can't speculate on his motivations. Well, the only thing that I can speak about is what is, you know, something that any one of your listeners could also do. Just read the article that I've mentioned, or in fact they're linked in the piece that I've written, and just see that whether this is acceptable or ethical behavior for a journalist. That can you go to a prison and interview people, detainees there, and then claim that that's somehow the truth? You know, wouldn't a responsible journalist cast some doubt on, you know, the independence of that kind of testimony? So that is the kind of thing that I can speculate on, which is verifiable, which anybody among your listeners can actually go and read and say, see for themselves. Regarding his motivations, I can't say. You know, some people have this... I think what has happened is that for some people, the notion of anti-imperialism has become an anti-Western reflex, rather than assuming that, you know, okay, imperialism is not just an American thing. Russians also engage in imperialism. And to condemn imperialism where it occurs, they make imperialism become synonymous with whatever the United States does. And so what they do is that if the United States is critical of the Syrian regime, so they assume that somehow that regime is worth defending. I mean, that is, I don't know whether that is the case in the case of Fisk, whether that is the motivation or if it's something else, but that I can't speculate on. That's his, that is something that only he could possibly know. But the reason why I have been speaking about Fisk is that he has a big name. And even right now, since yesterday, that article has been cited in the media everywhere. Yesterday, a Labour MP was on television citing that article. So what happens is that has an impact on the public discourse. And at the beginning, you said something that there are all these different takes. So, but the fact is that actually, if you look at the facts, the verified facts, there are no takes. It's very obvious who the main author of violence in Syria is. We know very clearly. I mean, to give you one telling statistic, that in the first 3 months of the conflict, when the conflict was entirely unarmed, peaceful, this is before even the Free Syria Army was created, which was created in July 2011. So this is before any armed uprising existed. So in the first 3 months of the conflict, the regime snipers killed 887 protesters, unarmed protesters. So it's very obvious what's happening in Syria, and the body of evidence that we have until now, and coming from all these different sources, it comes from the UN, it comes from human rights organizations, it comes from medical charities, whether it's MSF, whether it's Physicians for Human Rights, and it comes from journalists, not just people like Fisk, because there's a whole lot of people who have been covering Syria, and many very, very credible journalists from all kinds of different media. And so the thing is that there's a wide consensus, and then you have this counter thesis. The problem with the counter thesis is that it has to somehow show that all these different organizations, all these different bodies, that they are somehow in collusion with each other, coming up with this one theory that, well, somehow the regime over here is committing mass crimes. Well, except there's evidence for that. And that's why it's being said. So that is not a take. That is a reality of Syria, that we have a regime which does target hospitals, which does commit industrial scale torture, and which has disappeared over 65,000 people. So these are not disputed facts. These are verifiable. There are credible sources which can confirm all of this.
And of course there's the whole other issue of the response to what happened, whether that's helping mm-hmm. the situation at all, what the interests of Trump and the United States, UK and France might be in intervening, whether the missile attack actually accomplished its own objectives, where they actually hit an actual chemical arms plant or facility. And they're all separate questions that maybe we'll get into those as well. We do have a caller, Elliot, on the line. Hold on just a second. I just want to reintroduce. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm Paul Rowland, and I'm speaking with Idris Ahmad, who wrote a piece. It's a year and a half ago now, but it's very relevant. I'm sure you'll probably be writing updates on that issue of...
I had to update it three times, considering other of journalistic malpractices that Fisk was involved in. So, I think I'll have to write an update for this too.
Okay. And so let's go to our first caller. Elliot, you're on the air.
Yeah, I'm very interested to hear the story about Fisk, who Chomsky used to be kind of very up on, because this past weekend, I heard another prominent Middle East journalist, Reese Ehrlich, on KPFA. And he was basically taking the same anti-American, pro-Syrian regime line that, that a chemical attack, bizarrely, could be a false flag operation by these radical Islamists deciding to chemically murder their own people, possibly their own families, which is, silly. And I think a lot of this goes all the way back to the Balkan Wars. There's this reflexive anti-Western, anti-American belief system on the far, far left that, the U.S. government is opposing certain outrages by essentially homicidal Slavic fascists in Serbia, then it's obvious that we have to rally to the side of the Serbs because they're obviously being oppressed by the West. And here we got, with apparently both Reese Ehrlich and Fisk, the same completely fabricated, ridiculous, implausible nonsense. I appreciate the guest, bringing out, what Fisk in his old age may apparently be up to, because it's so sad that that Assad is drenched in blood like Stalin. I mean, he's tortured and mutilated tens of thousands of his own defenseless people.
Okay, let's hear what our guest has to say about.
Yeah,
sure. Thank you.
Yeah, I'll listen on air.
All right.
Well, Elliot, I think you bring up a very, I think that's what you brought out, the most relevant analogy, because I think one of the disservice that has been done to the Syria debate is people always revert back to Iraq rather than to the Balkans, because this is more like the Balkans than it is like Iraq. And your point about this kind of apologia, yes, it's absolutely disgraceful. And even as you note, that this theory, just to highlight the absurdity of these theories, let me just give you a kind of a relevant example. In Japan, many years back, a cult, Aum Shinryoku, what they did is that they carried out a sarin attack in the underground. And so later on, their labs were discovered. You can actually look at the pictures of these labs because they are really elaborate, because sarin is not a thing that you can produce on the cheap. So they spent nearly $30 million to produce 1.3 liters of sarin. Now, when August 2013, the attack had happened, so it was the estimate was that it was almost a ton of sarin that was used in that attack. So the conspiracy theorists are saying that here are Syrians that who are living under siege, where food and medicine can't get in, but they are spending, if 30 million is for 1.3 liters, so let's assume that it's over $100 million on producing sarin, holding on to it so they can periodically gas their own children. I mean, how is it that they have never used it for battlefield advantage, even when they were about to lose the war? How is it that they never used it against their military opponents? Why do they only keep it so they could periodically gas themselves? I mean, just the absurdity of that thing is quite astonishing. And yes, you rightly point out that similar things had happened during the similar conspiracy theories that also emerged during the Balkans War. There was this famous attack in Sarajevo market, which was, once again, the whole false flag conspiracy theories were used to absolve the perpetrators of the attack. In fact, there are books. You mentioned Chomsky, and one of the unfortunate things that he did was that he endorsed a book by this author who's now a Le Pen supporter, an author called Dana Johnstone, who wrote a book basically denying that there was any genocide had occurred or any massacre had occurred in Srebrenica. So, or she downplayed it. And so Chomsky wrote an endorsement for that. So you have... It's an unfortunate thing that you have this kind of a discourse, which is this reflexive contrarianism, that you don't look at what's happening on the ground. You don't look at who, like in the case of a place like Syria, that you have a ruthless regime at war with its own people. So people are not looking at what's happening on the ground. They're only looking at it through the prism of domestic politics. So for Chomsky, for example, the reflex is always, okay, the U.S. government has to be wrong about everything. And a lot of the times it is. I mean, Iraq War, we all oppose it because obviously that was wrong. I wrote a book about it, and it was, there was clearly, it was an unjustified, unprovoked war.
But what was the name of your book? The name of your book again?
The book is called The Road to Iraq.
Okay. Continue, sorry.
So the book was an investigation of the flawed intelligence process and how the public debate was shaped, how the propaganda was manufactured to justify the war against Iraq. And the thing was that a lot of people use that analogy that, look, this is like Iraq. Well, but it's not. In 2003, there was no immediate humanitarian catastrophe in Iraq that required any kind of intervention. I mean, you could have said that in 1988, when Saddam Hussein was gassing the Kurds, that would be a relevant analogy. I mean, that you can debate whether that there somebody should have intervened to stop him when he was gassing the Kurds. That could be a relevant analogy because that is like Syria. But 2003, Iraq was completely different. Secondly, the thing was that Saddam Hussein was alleged to have possessed weapons of mass destruction at the time. I mean, he did in the 80s. He had chemical weapons. But in 2003, UN and all kinds of independent bodies, even journalism, and even, I mean, this is something people forget, that even the intelligence agencies, despite pressure from Dick Cheney at the time, they did not give Bush the endorsement. They did not endorse Bush's case. In fact, if you read the 2002, the national intelligence estimate at the time, so the intelligence agencies actually put large caveats. They said that Iraq may develop a nuclear weapon in 10 years. That's what they said. They didn't say that they have it now. Syria is different because not only is the regime, has the regime acknowledged its possession of chemical weapons? It has actually been using them, and the UN Independent Commission on Syria has confirmed at least 34 instances in which the regime has used chemical weapons. So this is way different than 2003, when, if you remember, Al-Baradei from the IAEA, and you had Hans Blix from the UN. So they all refused to endorse. They said that, well, no, they can't find any evidence of actual weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. So people forget that the UN didn't endorse the case back then, and they draw this completely facile comparison with Iraq in 2003.
But so we will, since you're talking about the, you know, the you're not saying that intervention is necessarily a good thing, but you're posing the question of whether and what kind of intervention might be that some situations might require intervention, but you're not saying that necessarily the U.S., U.K., French intervention in this case or necessarily any other cases is a good thing, because, I mean, one can question the motives of these players. I certainly question the motives in just about every case of the United States intervention. I tend to be anti-U.S. interventionism. I don't go so far as to support the regimes like the Assad regime and others for my own political purposes, because I think that's irresponsible. But yet, this part of the nitty-gritty here is, did the U.S., U.K., French missile attack, did it actually achieve its objectives? Do you know about what actually happened with those missile strikes?
Well, the objectives were basically completely irrelevant to the Syrian people, because they hit three chemical weapon sites, which is now confirmed by satellite imagery. So that's not in doubt. But the thing is that in Syria, the majority of people have not been killed by chemical weapons. They have been killed by conventional weapons. So to the people in Syria, that is not going to make much of a difference. Although, the thing is that there's another factor, that whether there should be any kind of enforcement of prohibitions like the prohibition on chemical weapons, whether that is useful or not. I mean, that is something that I certainly believe that, yes, there should be some kind of international mechanism for holding these people to account. And unfortunate thing is, because of the completely flawed UN system, because of the Security Council vetoes, Russia has prevented any kind of investigations or certainly accountability. So you can't have any kind of international criminal court referrals, because Russia vetoes any possibility of war crimes being tried. And the same thing that the U.S. does in Israel. You know, U.S. protects Israel and Russia protects Syria. So the thing is that because of that system, the veto system, accountability is never delivered, and when there's no accountability, it creates this general climate of impunity in which anybody thinks that they can commit war crimes and they can get away with it. And now the thing regarding the intervention, the question is an interesting one, because your caller had mentioned the case of Bosnia. Now, Bosnia, 4 years, you had a pretty horrific war, and all kinds of ugly things happened. And in the end, it did take a very brief U.S. involvement to end that war. And now the place has been, now this is nearly 23 years on, that you have had some kind of peace. I mean, it's not a perfect peace, but at least what has happened is that you haven't had the kind of bloodshed that was happening before that. So I think that I would like, for example, in the case of Iraq war, it was very obvious that that is not something that anybody could be would be able to justify. I mean, even back then we knew that Saddam Hussein is a nasty guy. But the thing is that when you introduce war in a situation, so there are all kinds of unforeseen consequences. And we saw that in the case of Iraq, that you had all kinds of unforeseen consequences, and it led to a massive humanitarian and political catastrophe. And but what happens is that one of the things that is rarely considered, or at least because the Iraq example has shown us that how disastrous interventions can be, so one of the things that doesn't get considered enough are that, does inaction also have consequences? Because here, once again, I'll give you one statistic which is kind of telling about Syria, that the first major chemical attack that happened in Syria was in August, on August 21st, 2013. and over 1,000 people were killed in that chemical attack. And that was when the whole debate happened about Obama's red line and whether there should be any kind of action. And in the end, Obama stood down, and he declared victory because the Syrian regime relinquished some of its stocks of sarin, and that was destroyed, and it was seen as a victory, or at least presented as a victory by Obama. But there were consequences, because that was a red line that Obama had drawn. And at the time that he drew the red line, in August 2012, a year before the attack, everybody was kind of shocked by that. Why is he drawing a red line on something which the regime isn't even using? Obama's rationale at that time was that he wanted to appear engaged without necessarily wanting to get engaged, because at the time Obama was more interested in disengaging from that region. So the consequence of that was that the regime took it as a green light for every other kind of attack, because essentially Obama had said, well, don't do just this one thing, everything else, you know, there will be no consequences. That's how the regime read it. But the regime was also, because they understand power, dictatorships, that's one thing that they are good at. So what they realized was that maybe let's test this one red line too. And that's what they did in August 2013. They tested the red line, and soon when Obama stood down, the regime at that point escalated. So the statistic that I was going to tell you was that by that time, the death toll, the highest death toll that had been calculated at the time, was about 100,000 people had been killed in the war. In the next, that was the 29th month of the conflict. In the next 29 month, there'll be 400,000 people killed. So you had a fourfold increase in the level of violence. You also had a discrediting of the opposition, which had at least rhetorically aligned itself with the West. You also had the massive spike in the refugee flows after August 2013. And you had then 2015, it blew up into the whole what was called the refugee crisis. So you had this massive consequences that ensued from not doing something, because the regime realized that, well, it can do anything with impunity at that time. So I think that is one of the things that also needs to be considered. Yes, we should be wary of any kind of unprovoked interventionism because it has consequences. But if situations like these arise, we have to also consider that what are the costs of inaction?
Yes, these are incredibly complex things at levels that those of us speaking and listening have a hard time comprehending, and probably maybe even want to avoid thinking about such things, having such a really awesome responsibilities, because you know these geopolitical situations exist, these horrible regimes exist, the horrible history of the United States and its terrible interventions around the world exists. All this exists, and we unfortunately can't escape it. But I'm speaking with Idris Ahmad about the Syrian quagmire of atrocity and Robert Fisk's reporting and how that plays into the situation. But we've had Dave waiting very patiently. Hopefully he's still on the line to ask his question or make his comment. Go ahead.
Yeah, how are you? I've been paying attention to this for many years now, I guess 2013 as well. And the issue of Saudi Prince Bandar providing that gas, especially the incident in 2013, I was during the wait, I was looking for the news article for attribution on it. I didn't find it immediately, but the story was that the there was a small rebel group, and if I understand right, there were 1,500 rebel groups in Syria. It's not just Al-Qaeda, it's not just ISIS, but there are 1,500 different rebel groups. And so this little group of about a dozen people were given this sarin gas by Saudi Prince Bandar. They were not trained in its use. And they were lobbying, using a mortar to lob the sarin into a residential area, and one of the gas canisters was down in a bunker with about 10 of the rebel group, and they all died immediately when somebody dropped it. And so the surviving member of that group outed Saudi Prince Bandar as the perpetrator of the sarin gas in 2013. I'm glad that that earlier caller raised the issue of Yugoslavia and the idea of hitting hospitals. I had a cable access TV show out here in San Francisco back in the late 90s when that incident happened where we had bombed. If I remember right, there were 69 hospitals that the United States bombed, and of those 69, they would do an initial airstrike and then wait 15 minutes until the emergency crews showed up, ambulances, police, emergency rescue people who were pulling bodies from the wreckage, and then the U.S. would strike again. And so that was a policy of the U.S. government back in Yugoslavia.
Well, you've introduced two very large things. Let's get Idris's response.
Sure. Well, I was going to ask actually if he's also familiar with SyrianPerspective.com.
Okay, go ahead, Idris.
Okay, so the first story, I think you're referring to this story that appeared on a website called mintpress.com, and it was presented as an AP story, which it wasn't, and the author was a guy, was supposed to be a woman named Dale Gablek, who disavowed the story. The website Mintpress is an Iranian funded conspiracy site, and so the story was quite absurd, because what they did was, I mean, just to give you an idea of what they were claiming, they claim that Saudi Prince Bandar had given sarin to rebels who were in a tunnel trying to use it, and they accidentally blew up. Now, okay, let's look at the plausibility of that story, because the attack, the chemical attack on Ghouta in August 2013, they had happened on two geographically completely separated areas. In fact, there were 12 locations in which the sarin had struck. So one person in one neighborhood, I mean, you're literally talking about, let's say, that I don't know the geography of, you know, Portland, but if you're talking about an incident that happened, if you're familiar with the geography of New York, let's imagine that one, somebody blew up sarin somewhere in the underground in Bronx, and yet some people in Brooklyn were also affected. So it was something like that you had this completely geographically separated and in between their regime territories, so these areas. So the claim was not only that it was physically impossible, but also the interesting thing about that claim was that, as with most conspiracy theories, that it ignored the fact that there was actual physical evidence of the rockets that had delivered the chemical attacks. There were UN had measurements of the rockets. There are photos of it. There are extensive UN reporting on it. So they have also collected samples of it. So the thing was that there was all this physical evidence available. There were all these witness testimonies available, and you had extensive investigations into it. And so OPCW was able to visit, that they were able to confirm all the details of what had happened. So this is what I meant earlier on, that when we speak about takes, one of the problems that we have right now is internet has made it possible. On one hand, it's a great place for information that we are exposed to, like more information that we were in the past, and we can now go and verify things. But one of the things it has also enabled is that anybody who wants to start disinformation, it is just as easy as just going on the internet and posting some silly story, and it gets picked up and it gets amplified, and it comes to the point that somebody said that it's very, very easy to plan the story, I think it was Mark Twain, that by the time it's the falsehood has gone around the world before the truth has even a chance to put on its boots. So this is the kind of situation that we have at the moment, that we have all these stories. So I'm surprised that, you know, this story, for example, came up, because this was very quickly discredited back then, the story about Prince Bandar being involved. And so you get a lot of these exaggerations and stories. I mean, so for example, in the Balkans, regarding the targeting of hospitals. Now, once again, these are very serious matters for which it's important to have evidence. This is, U.S. has, for example, in FATA, where I had been covering the drone war for quite a few years, and in fact, one of the things was that I had reported on the underreporting of civilian casualties. And one of the means that under Obama was introduced, one of the tactics, was a double tap strike, which used to be that a place a low-level militant would get hit in a drone strike, and then when people would come in for the rescue, so then they would get bombed again. And this was a practice that was widely then denounced, and we actually created a campaign against it as well, and the Bureau of Investigative Journalism did a really outstanding work exposing this tactic, showing many instances of this. So that there are serious, this is a serious violation, and it was necessary because we use all kinds of means. Some of our people who were involved with us were involved in actual taking, starting court cases against the CIA chief at the time, who was based in Pakistan. So there are all kinds of measures that were taken against it. So that's why it becomes necessary to be precise about the details. I mean, this is the first time I'm hearing that number of hospitals were bombed in the Balkans. I'll have to look that up. I can't say off the top of my head such a thing happened. If it had happened, I would have known about it, because this is the kind of things I investigate. And now the thing is that in Syria, that double tap strategy has now become so systematic. It has become so systematic that the regime actually posts videos of it itself. So there's actually the Syrian army's front page had a video of white helmets, the rescue workers being targeted, and they had very proudly mentioned, I mean, so there are actually now videos of these double tap strikes occurring, because the Russians and the Syrian regime, they turned this strategy into a common everyday practice, that they bomb a place, they wait for all the rescuers and medics to gather, and then they come in and they start bombing again. In fact, the film that had won the Oscar 2 years back on the white helmets, there was a short documentary. The very first scene in it, it's captured by one of the volunteers' helmet camera. You can see the double tap strike happening, that here are all these people gathering to rescue some children of the rubble, and the next thing, all of them are, a bomb hits all of them. So you have the reality of this. And as a journalism teacher and as a journalist and as just a citizen, my plea to everybody right now is that they should make an effort to be precise with the information they get, and to be skeptical without being cynical, to put every information that they're receiving to some scrutiny, and seeing that, is the source credible? What are the sources? Is it credible? Is it plausible? So that is something that I hope that everybody starts doing more, because we live in a time when it's a time of, as George Orwell called it, it's a time of universal deceit. We are seeing so many falsehoods, and we need to be able to challenge them.
That is excellent advice that we all should take. In that spirit, let's go to our next caller, Regan. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm so glad you're covering this topic. I just got done reading the book Burning Country, which has been hugely influential on me on this topic. And as a progressive, I've been so frustrated with the response to these recent air attacks, the too quick disbelief of this being a chemical weapons attack, and the too quick condemnation of the air attacks, airstrikes. And just, it seems to me, and this is kind of what I would love to see you address, is that Syria is basically a crimes against humanity conflict. And I think progressives, especially in this country, are too quick to lump it in with past intervention, American intervention into Middle Eastern situations, i.e. obviously the Iraq War of 2003. And I just kind of wonder, why progressives can't see that this is a crimes against humanity conflict, and we should be advocating to do something about it. And I'm not exactly sure what we can do or what we should do. I know my knee-jerk impulse is always against acts of war, but it does seem like, I mean, for 7 years now, the Syrian people, the Syrian opposition has been getting slaughtered and tortured and, you know, all of these other atrocities, including children. And that progressives are doing throw the baby out with the bathwater type of situation, where we're lumping it in with all these other conflicts. And so maybe if you could address how this Syria is different and what progressives can do, I would love to hear you comment on that.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks, Regan. First of all, the book that Regan recommended, I would highly recommend it to your readers. It's an outstanding book. It's written by two Syrian authors. It's called Burning Country, and it's based on interviews with people who led the revolution. So it's based on extensive research with the people who were involved in the original revolution. So it's actual Syrian voices explaining what led them to the revolution, what were the conditions that led them to that. So it's a book that that I would recommend, that if anybody wants to get a good sense of what's happening in Syria, Burning Country is the book that they can go to. And now regarding the your comment, I absolutely agree with that I think that we need to be more, we need to think situationally, that we need to take every instance, take every situation on its own merits rather than making facile comparisons with situations which may not be analogous. And in the case of for example, in what happened in Syria recently, Syria and Iraq, I would say it. So anybody who has a absolute rejection of intervention, you know, I am fine with absolute pacifism, although I have reasons why I don't. I mean, I accept that as a very, it can be a noble position, even though I think that its consequences sometimes can be, especially if you're a pacifist in the face of injustice. So I don't think it helps any kind of situation. But what happens is that people need to consider, for example, the fact that recently, well, not very recently, but a few years back, when ISIS was slaughtering Yazidis, so many of them had taken refuge on a mountain. It's called Sinjar Mountain. So they had taken refuge over there, and in the end, it was an intervention by the U.S. Which prevented these people from being slaughtered. And these people were not only being slaughtered, their women being enslaved and raped. So this was a horrific situation for the people. And they were, in that instance, that one intervention did protect a people who are already endangered from being completely slaughtered. Same thing happened in Kobani, that in Kobani, the U.S. was able to protect Kurds from being slaughtered by the ISIS advances. Now, this has been one of the Syrians' big complaint, and this is something that I hope that, you know, everybody will have to consider. Why do we see so much concern over, if let's say that this, the people who call themselves anti-imperialists, if they are anti-imperialists, why is it that they are only protesting now? Because this airstrike was the 15,201st airstrike in Syria. Since September 2014, the U.S. has launched over 15,000 airstrikes. But why was there an objection to this one and not to all the previous ones? Is it because anti-imperialism has come to mean simply defense of Assad? I mean, do they? Why is it that the previous all instances of the bombings were not objected to? So if there's a principal objection, that should be to all airstrikes. And then that also means that people who are principally objecting to airstrikes, they should also be raising their voices against the airstrikes which have done the most damage, which are by the Syrian regime and Russia.
I think we're going to have to wind down here on that point. I just wanted to sort of point out, you're talking about the Syrian revolution kind of, it's so so bitter, you know, to that we forget all about the heady days of the Arab Spring, when the youth and others were uprising, had such high hopes to actually change those regimes, and it's devolved into such a...
If I could just say something quickly there, that in the past year, because there's a lot of talk about Al-Qaeda, rebel groups and all, in the past few months, so all these, the revolution hasn't been completely defeated. It has gone underground because the violence has completely submerged it. But what has happened is that recently, all the original revolutionaries, they kicked out Al-Qaeda from many places in the Idlib province. From there was Sarakeb, Marat al-Noman, and there were all these towns in which they rose up. The same civil protesters who had risen up against the regime, they also rose up against Al-Qaeda, and they banished them from their towns.
And there's also
think that's why.
Yeah, sorry, we got to go, but there's also the whole issue of Rojava and all the high hopes for the Kurdish autonomous region there, that a lot of anarchists, especially here in the States, are supporting. But there's so many complexities to this, and I'm glad you were able to take time out, Idris Ahmad, to point some of them out, and hopefully we'll be able to continue this discussion in the future. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Okay.
Thank you.
And check out my website, kbo.fm, Wednesday Talk Radio, for some of the links to his pieces and other important information. And stay tuned for Lisa Loving and a roundtable discussion on the Portland City Hall race. This is Paul Roland with KBOO Wednesday Talk Radio.
KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Folk Music Society April Concert. On Friday, April 20th, the award-winning original roots music group Kathy Boyd and Phoenix Rising will be coming to the Portland Folk Music Society concert stage at 2901 Southeast Steel Street. Doors at 7, concert starts at 7:30. Global Music Awards winner in the categories of lyrics, songwriters, and album for the newest release, 40 Years of Lonesome. Once again, that's Kathy Boyd and Phoenix Rising, Friday, April 20th, Reedwood Friends Church, 2901 Southeast Steel Street, Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934. And certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is also available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Board meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month, starting at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
This is KBOO Portland.